This is FUV Live Sessions, a podcast brought to you by WFUV in New York City. Each week, we talk to artists in our Bronx studio or at venues around the city, and we listen to them play a live set. You'll get to hear the songs and learn about the artist or band. Episodes drop every Monday wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow the show to stay up to date on all the latest episodes, and you might even find your next favorite artist, band, album, or song. And if you like what you hear, please make sure that you rate and review the show so other music lovers can find it. This is FUV Live Sessions with Ben Gibbard of Death Cab for Cutie. I'm Megan Suma, and I'm here with host Alisa Ali at WFUV. Alisa, this episode is going to be a little bit different for listeners. So we got a remote interview with Ben from Death Cab, and we got some exclusive live tracks from a studio session that they did in Seattle. You and Ben had a very fun, very candid chat that was a lot of fun to listen to. Listeners are going to hear it in a second, but talk to me about getting to catch up with Ben and talking to him about kind of these dual projects that he was working on.
Well, we've been a fan of Ben's music for a long time with Death Cab for Cutie, and we loved that Postal Service album that he put out. And so we talked a little bit about Death Cab for Cutie stuff, as well as that Postal Service anniversary tour, along with an anniversary tour he did for Death Cab. So it was really fun to catch up about all of those previous projects. And we also, of course, talked about the longevity of his career, turning 50. He looks, sounds amazing. He's clearly in good shape vocally and mentally. And I love this new record. It is very interesting. It's very inside baseball for him, obviously. He made it. So I think maybe we had a couple of different perspectives on the music. As a listener, it kind of landed in one way for me. And as the maker of the record, he was kind of intending it to be a different way. But we talked about this, and it's so interesting. And as with all music, like, you know, once you release it into the world, it's not yours really anymore, and it's open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. And he's totally cool with that, and I love that about him. He's got some great opinions. He's very funny, and we also share a love of Paul Simon, which we found out through a little bit of an Easter egg plant on the record for two different versions of one song, which I love, and it's a great album.
Yeah, it's a great album. So we're going to hear three live songs. Again, these were recorded at Studio Litho in Seattle. What is the first song that we're going to hear in this session?
The first song we're going to hear from this session from his new album, I Built You a Tower, is Full of Stars.
Please forgive me these nights. My head is full of stars, of constellations retreating away from where we are. And I fear I'll soon be wishing on an empty sky. I've got this anguish I know we'll never be satisfied. It's always hungry, so I feed it and have the nerve to wonder why it keeps growing and throwing tantrums just like a child. And all I need for you to be kind, but it seems it's rarely worth your time. I tried to mend these broken fences. You claimed I'd built a wall, that I'd obstructed all your exits. As if my aim all along was to keep you somewhere you no longer wish to be. And all I need is for you to be kind, but it seems it's rarely worth your time. All I need is for you to be kind, but it seems it's rarely worth your time. Rarely worth your time. It's rarely worth your time.
A live version of Full of Stars here on member-supported WFUV. I am Alisa Ali. That, of course, was Death Cab for Cutie with the opening track from their most recent album, I Built You a Tower, their 11th full-length release. I'm here talking with Ben Gibbard. Ben, congratulations on the new record, and thank you for spending some time with us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
We love the new album. It is a really lovely rumination on going through some hard times. And what I like about this record too is that there are no answers here. Sometimes people like to wrap things up nicely with a bow at the end, but yeah. That's not how you roll. And I appreciate that about you. But this is a very reflective first song to start off the record. Can you tell me a little bit about the making of this album? And I know that you kind of went into making this album right after you did a bunch of those reunion tours. You were celebrating 20 years and of two different albums. And you also were fronting two different bands. You did a Death Cab and a Postal Service tour kind of all in one. That seems like a major undertaking. What was the thought process behind doing all of that, going really big like that?
I think we've gotten to a place now culturally where sometimes the term fan service is used as a pejorative, which I find kind of funny in the sense that any live show is fan service, you know, like going out and doing a show and playing, you know, songs from across one's catalog, hopefully for the pleasure of an audience, is quite literally fan service, and that's why we do it. And I felt that I was in a unique position in the sense that, you know, as much as I can say it without ego, I can't think of another artist or band that has been the author of two, or partial author, I should say, of two albums that have had such an impact in the course of one calendar year. I don't think anybody else is. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm more than willing to be wrong about this. But I thought it would be a unique brand of fan service and something that only I and we were able to do, both of these records together in one show. And it took a lot of work to put the show together, but we had a blast. It was just really, it was so much fun to kind of finally, you know, put this Venn, allow this Venn diagram to exist in real life on a stage. And it was just really, really wonderful. We had a great time.
Fronting two different huge, I'm a big fan of Postal Service and Death Cab for Cutie. So I won't correct you in saying that those were two very big things that happened. But I have to think that, you know, being the front man for those particular shows, that must have been like a very different experience. You know what I mean? Because usually you have an opening band, right? And then you come out and then you give it your all, but you're kind of giving it your all twice. So that it just seems like a really intense tour to do that with. Was it not intense, or was it just, it's you? So I guess it was just normal. Maybe it was just a really long Ben Gibbard show.
Well, I mean, to be honest, it wasn't
performance.
It wasn't any longer than a normal Death Cab show. And it was actually physically less demanding. I mean, when Death Cab plays a 2-hour show, we're leaning into a lot of the more upbeat material, and I'm out there the whole time, and, you know, I don't get a break. And in this case, you know, Transatlanticism is a rather down-tempo record. There's only 2 or 3 songs that are, maybe 4, that are kind of up-tempo. Then we were getting a 15-minute break in between the sets, and then we were coming out and having a dance party for 45 more minutes. So I wrote both of those records at the same time. You know, one day in, it would be 2001, and one day I'm writing District Sleeps Alone Tonight, and the next day I'm writing The New Year, or something like that. So these records were being made at the same time. So, and they are, of course, all a reflection of my experiences as a human being. So it didn't feel awkward. It wasn't difficult. And in a strange way, it was physically less demanding because I would get a reset in the middle of the show. And, you know, when Death Cab plays and we do I Will Follow You Into the Dark, everybody leaves the stage except for obviously me. So, you know, it was nice to kind of have that experience of getting a chance to get off stage, have a little bit of a reset, and then come back out.
And I think so right after those tours, you kind of wanted to harness the energy of that live experience, and you just went right back into the studio to make this new album. And, you know, it's not as upbeat also as some of your other material. Is that was that informed by the tour and like kind of slowing down the pace a little bit with these down tempo songs?
You think it's a down tempo record, really?
Shit. Some of the songs are. I mean, you know, Full of Stars is kind of, you know, reflective. It's not like we're not dancing to that.
Well, no, Full of Stars, certainly not. That. Yeah, certainly not. Pound for Pound, it's a fairly up-tempo record. Maybe that's just, maybe my sense of up-tempo is distorted by being in Death Cab for Cutie. But I do think that, you know, I did find in the playing of these older songs, exclusively these songs that I wrote when I was 26, you know, it allowed for more time on stage existing in that version of myself, and allowed me to really understand what made that record work so well. And I think, and in turn, some of the older records, to this day, when we play songs from the first 3 or 4 records, they just feel very different from a lot of the stuff we've made in the last 10 years. And I would ask myself the question, I started asking myself the question, why is that? And I came to the conclusion that a lot of it had to do with process. It was like the first 3 records and half of Transatlanticism were written and demoed on 4-track. For those who may not be familiar who are listening, you know, 4-track is a machine that would take a regular cassette and run all 4 tracks in one direction. You could multi-track on it. It was what we had before we had Pro Tools and GarageBand. And because I was working in this analog medium, I had to play the drums first, and then I had to like play a guitar on top of it, and I had to then add things. I had to do full performances of songs and have everything pre-written. And I started to realize that one of the reasons those songs worked so much is that I was writing songs to my own drumming. Since I started recording in computers, I was using a lot of drum machines or loops off of old records or cutting up vocals, or I was writing to a lot of myself not playing, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And I leaned really hard into making all of these loops of myself playing drums, like writing what I thought were like hooks on the drums, the way like you'd write a guitar riff. So like something like Punching the Flowers has this like boom, bop, ba-doom, bop, bop, boom, boom, bop, ba-doom, bop, bop. Something you could hear it and go, oh, I know what that song is. It's like a riff. You can sing it. Yeah. And so I wanted to lean into, that was the process by which I used to write songs. And I decided that I wanted to start from that similar place again and see where I could get.
Give me a little pep talk about this song, Pep Talk, that we're going to get into next and how that one came about. And have you ever really given yourself a good pep talk? Has it ever worked?
I guess it has, because I was able to get myself out of bed, you know, in those moments.
Is that because of the pep talk you gave?
You know,
it makes no difference sometimes.
It does. Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, I think at the end of the day, the pep talk is to get oneself out of bed. But then once is out of bed, all of the things that made you not want to get out of bed still exist and still need to be dealt with. And that's where the real work comes in. Yeah. And I just think that, you know, with that song, it's, you know, there are these moments when we are very down, where we kind of scary voices start to come into our heads. And we start to think about, like, what if we weren't around here, you know? Mm-hmm. And those are, and if the hope is that people don't have those voices that often, but sometimes those voices creep in and they're really fucking scary, you know? And you know, so this song is kind of about those moments where you have these kind of voices, even if they're quiet voices of self-harm or thinking about, like, what if I just wasn't around? And realizing it's kind of a plea to the people around you to be like, hey, if you see me start slipping, you gotta, like, I'm telling you, this is difficult and I need your help. To me, I mean, it seems to me, it's like that kind of, you know, John Lennon had help and I have pep talk, you know, it's one of those yeah. moments where you just say, like, look, I need some help, you know? Yeah. And I think that as a Gen Xer, we're not used to asking people for help. We're used to just suffering quietly mm-hmm. until one day we just explode, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of our way. And it's something that, you know, I think a lot of people, self-aware people of our generation, are trying to kind of break free of that stoicness that doesn't really do much, doesn't help us as much as we might think it does.
No. And I just feel like, you know, giving yourself a pep talk is useless, but when other people can give you that pep talk, that's really what, because if you give yourself a pep talk, it's kind of like you're Stuart Smalley, like, I'm good enough. I'm, you know, smart enough. Gosh darn it, people like me. But when mm-hmm. other people get involved, that is when, you know, you start to feel more held and more able to move on. And so I think that's what you're doing with this song, is kind of bringing that community together. What I was going to ask you was, what is the best pep talk that you've ever received, and who gave it to you?
That's a good question. Well, before I answer that question, I want to go back and just reference, are you familiar with Ricky Henderson? Do you know who Ricky Henderson is? He was a baseball player. He played for the Oakland A's for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And he would allegedly be in the box, and he'd be like, okay, Ricky's going to get a hit. He would speak to himself in third person.
Third person.
The catcher and the umpire would be like, come on, Ricky, you can do this, Ricky. He would say this to himself. He's in the Hall of Fame, so it worked for him. This is a very long time ago. It was 1996, and my old band was playing a show in Bellingham, and we were opening for a band called MK Ultra from San Francisco. And this band I was in was like a two-singer-songwriter band, and I really felt that I was the lesser of the two songwriters, that I was less gifted than the other songwriter in the band. And, you know, there were elements around us that seemed to kind of confirm that, whether, you know, at least people, you know, the way cliques work with that kind of stuff, you know.
Okay.
And so I felt a little diminished. And I remember we played this band, MK Ultra, that was fronted by a man named John Vanderslice, who is a great singer, songwriter, artist in his own right. At the time, he wasn't a solo artist on Barsook. He was, you know, he was a singer of this band. And one of the bass player in MK Ultra, whose name I cannot remember off the top of my head, I feel terrible about it. But after the show, after our set, he came up and he was like, hey, that was great. I was like, oh, thanks a lot. He's like, but you're the guy. And I was like, what? And he was like, no, you're the guy. You're the guy in this band. And I was like, no one had said that to me before. Like, no one had picked me out and said, like, you are talented. And it's an odd thing. It's like, it's something, my dad and I have this conversation sometimes. One of his conversation starters with people he meets who are in the arts or who are accomplished in some form or fashion are like, who is the person who first told you you were good at this? You know, who is the person who pointed you, said, you're the person, you can do this. My dad's story is he was in nursing school and he was really struggling. And he had this one professor who had said, like, hey, I know you're smart enough to do this. Like, I know, you know, my dad grew up in a trailer in Ann Arbor and, you know, didn't really have a lot growing up. And he was kind of intimidated at university. And he had this professor who was like, no, you're the person who can, you can do this. I know you can do this. And in a strange way, the bass player from MKUltra was this person for me. It was like I was starting to feel disillusioned in this band I was in. And I had started to think about doing my own thing, but I didn't have the motivation or the confidence to do it. And I wouldn't say as a direct result of this boost of confidence that he gave me, but it certainly was a part of a larger groundswell of self-confidence that I was starting to build that allowed me to make the first Death Cab tape. And that I realized that I had the ability, I had more competency and ability than I thought I did. But a lot of it stemmed from him just saying, like, you're the guy. Everybody always says that, everybody in my community is saying the other guy was the guy, but I'm telling you that you're the guy. And that was a strangely important moment for me.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, that's very necessary. And I could see how you could move forward with confidence after someone says, you're the guy. All right, you're the guy who is going to give us a pep talk in the form of this song. So we'll get live music from Death Cab for Cutie right now on member-supported WFUV.
I like to tidy up. No blames and explaining away, they are born from my cup. Rebounds always running me down like a lion on the plains. But this faith is its own escape, so I just stand in place. And now I find sunrise and just lying in bed, giving myself a pep talk to survive the day lying ahead. My past is a whiskey glass tipping down a drunkard's slope. I can't claim I was ever ashamed when I drank the antidote. Sunrise and just lying in bed, giving myself a pep talk to survive the day lying ahead. But they make no difference. All of the colors blend into black. And if I raise the stakes and step out on the ledge, you gotta pull me. Out on the ledge, I'm never coming back. And they make no difference. All of the colors blend into black. And if I raise the stakes and step out.
Pep Talk, a live version of the song from the new Death Cab for Cutie album, I Built You a Tower, the 11th full-length release from this great band. And I, Alisa Ali, am here talking with Ben Gibber. Congratulations on your new record. Well played with that pep talk. And can you talk a little bit about the theme behind the album, I Built You a Tower? And the tower, of course, you know, a lot of people could think that this is like, I think most people, when they think of building a tower, you think of like the damsel in distress in the tower, or maybe you think of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, which actually might be more, that actually might be more accurate. Can you talk a little bit about this theme?
Yeah, well, those seem to be the most popular towers, I suppose. The CN Tower is fairly popular in Canada, you know. Sears Tower, yep, exactly.
Tower of Power.
Yep, exactly. Great band. I started to envision my life, or just the lives of people, as kind of like a skyline. Like if you look out at the, you know, if you're in an airplane looking at Manhattan or something like that, and there are all these different buildings of different sizes, and that, you know, in my mind, my life was like an island of all these buildings, in which the larger, more prominent ones represent more significant moments or periods in my life, or people in my life, you know, and the memories and the experiences, both good and bad, that, you know, the joys, the traumas, everything exists in those buildings. And that, you know, the smaller five-story buildings, they might be, you know, less significant, but still memories in my life, right? The memories of these people, the stories, the experiences, everything exists in these structures. And you can kind of go and visit them if you like. You can go and you can open the door and you can go in there and you can live with those memories for a moment. But at the end of the day, what keeps you from going insane is that you can kind of close the doors on those chapters and then go back into the current moment with the knowledge that all of that, those experiences and people are existing in those kind of structures. But I think that as much as we are able to compartmentalize eras of our life, both good and bad, there are also these moments where the people and the experiences, the memories just break, they break open, they break free. And, you know, you might walk around the corner and you might walk by like a restaurant that is serving a food you can smell that reminds you of a time in your life or a person, or you might hear a song on the radio and be taken right back to that period in your life, good or bad, be flooded with memories. Or you might just run into somebody on the street and it might just trigger a whole set of emotions or memories that maybe that you were not in that moment either ready or even possibly willing to manage, you know? So I started to think about that as a creative driver that resulted in the songs I Built You a Tower, A and B, but also that just were a theme that was starting to kind of emerge out of the songs I've been writing for the record.
I love that you have an A and B song. Can you talk a little bit about coming up with two different versions of that?
Sure. You know, when we're writing songs for a record, I mean, we had 90 songs going into this record. It was just like,
wow.
And you know, I mean, there's a reason you haven't heard them all, of course. but you know, often saying 90 songs sounds like a lot until you realize that there are moments in which sets of lyrics are being used for different pieces of music, maybe unsuccessfully trying to express an idea that five iterations down the road becomes a song that is on the record that you're hearing. But we found ourselves with these two songs that tonally very different, that were using a similar set of lyrics. And we realized that they worked as really nice bookends for the record, in the sense that I Built You a Tower A is this very kind of classic Death Cab song. There's a melancholy in it, but it doesn't really, to me at least, it doesn't present itself as a overly melancholic song. You know, there's a line in the bridge about, there are days I wish you'd become an acquaintance, or a time to time someone like this. It's a little bit of a slightly acerbic lyric. In placing I Built You a Tower B at the end of the record, which is this very loud, angular kind of song, with a similar lyric, but ends the concludes the record with the line, "I'm learning how to live without you, and it makes me tired." There's a resignation in it that I think works rather effectively as in conjunction with the earlier version of the song and a similar lyric set, almost identical lyric set. And you know, as we realized we had these two bookends on the record, I recalled one of my favorite Paul Simon records, which is Hearts and Bones, which is kind of in the story of Paul Simon's work. Hearts and Bones, I feel, is, I wouldn't say maligned, but it's, I don't believe it's championed as much. I think it's a really great record, and I feel that it has the unfortunate distinction of being the record before Graceland. So Graceland comes out and it's this massive record, and it almost sets up Hearts and Bones retroactively to be the lesser record, you know. But on that record, he has he has a song called Think Too Much A and Think Too Much B. And I really wanted to kind of use that nomenclature as like a tribute to that record and to Paul Simon, in which he uses a similar kind of, there's a similar, the lyrics are different. They're not used in the same fashion, but I like the idea of having A and B and presenting that nomenclature as a tribute to Paul Simon, who's like one of my favorite songwriters.
Oh, that's amazing. That's really interesting to know. Now, with this record, do you think that there will be like a continuation of it? Because as I was mentioning earlier, like there's no answers here. You know, you just kind of, you know, this is what's going on. I'm struggling through this race here. Do you think that at some point it's a goal, or would you want it to be a goal to kind of wrap that story up and be like, this is how it ended up?
Like I built you a tower too.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like I broke out of the tower, or, you know, like the tower fell down.
I think the record, it does actually conclude itself with the line, I'm learning how to live without you, and it makes me tired. It's like, you can compartmentalize your pain in any way you wish. Mm-hmm. And you can keep it compartmentalized for quite a while. I mean, people have experienced horrific things and bottled them up for decades, right? But eventually you will have to face it. And to me, and work through it. And I think for me, the resolution of the record is in that line of like, I'm learning how to live without you. Like this is an ongoing process.
Okay.
And I am accepting this outcome, and the fact that I have to walk through it, and I have to learn how to live with it. I have to learn to live with the outcome. So to me, I feel the record actually does conclude itself.
I was harping too much on the I'm tired part.
Well, I'm just tired. I'm almost 50, so I'm just tired all the time anyways. I mean, that's more of a statement. That could be a statement of
age.
That could be a statement of emotional distress, or just age, or the combination of both, you know.
How are you feeling about going into 50, by the way?
You know, I'm feeling, to say I'm at peace with it is to assume that I was, or infer that I was not at peace with it before. And the reality of the situation is, I'll give you a little anecdote that kind of sets up what I'm about to say. You know, last year I stumbled. I was cleaning out a storage locker. I was like, I hired somebody to help me like Marie Kondo the storage locker, basically like get all the stuff out of it, and you know, get rid of stuff that was just filling up space. And I found this box of letters that I wrote that I had received from a pen pal I had when I was like 15. And this was like this. You know, I had moved across the country. There's this young girl who I kind of knew, and it was very like innocent high school teenage stuff, you know, really adorable stuff. And I reread some of these letters because I was so curious. And I don't know what I'm saying to this person, but I from what she is writing back to me in 1991 or whatever, 92, I can ascertain what I'm saying, right? And at some point she writes in an early letter or something like, that's so cool that you want to be in a band. I just know you're going to make it. So it's clear that when I was like 14 or 15 years old, I was telling this person and probably a lot of people that this is what I wanted to do. Like I wanted to be in a band. That's at 14 or 15 years old. That's akin to saying like, I want to be president of the United States, you know, like it's a lofty goal, you know? And the fact that I'm turning 50 and this has been my job for 30 of the 50 years that I've been on this planet, that, you know, knocking on wood that I have my health and I'm able to move through the world doing the things I want to do, and that my brain and body are allowing me to do those things, I just feel unbelievably fortunate. And things have not all worked out the way I saw them working out. You know, it's like there are sacrifices along the way that one has to make. It's not everything works out the way you planned it, but at the same time, I wouldn't change anything. So the idea that turning 50, and I also feel like we'll see what the reviews say of this record, but I also feel like creatively I'm functioning I feel like I'm very content and happy with how I'm functioning on a creative level as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not to say that will always be the case, but I think that when you're a young person, you have a vision of what 30 is going to feel or look like, and 40 is going to feel and look like, or 50, and on and on and on. And I'm very pleased with how my life has turned out to this point. I'm pleased and proud of the person that I've become. Always a work in progress, of course, but I don't see it as this. I'm not dreading it. You know, I don't feel that much different than I did when I was 40, but I have 10 years of what I would hope would be emotional maturity. So, I don't know. Just try. Then also, I am very tired. I am tired, rather tired. I run extremely long distances. I was telling my partner yesterday, I would rather be exhausted from and tired from a long day in the mountains, as I was a few days ago, than just be tired because I'm existing on the planet, you know? Yeah. Like, the just waking up is hard, you know? So I'd rather have exhausted myself physically and have that as an excuse, other than like, no, I'm just a middle-aged man and my body hurts all the time.
Physically, yeah.
Physically,
no, yeah. I get that. Yes, I get that. Well, I am very proud of you as well, as you should be of yourself. You've created an incredible body of work. And I love your lyricism and your melodies. And actually, the last song that you're going to do for us, Stone Over Water, has such a really cool image of skipping stones, kind of feeling that floating, like, successful feeling, but then dropping in. And it's so easy to picture that. And it's such a really strong image that you've conjured. So thank you so much for doing this song and for all of the music over the years, and long may you run, and long may you rest also. Like, sit down, enjoy yourself, have a glass of wine. Here's 250 more. Okay. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you.
Francisco couldn't handle, so how this year's been a slog, melting both ends of the candle. And how I wish I could claim that I don't harbor ill feelings, as my anger's turning to shame, and I stare a hole through the ceiling. And try him to hold it together,
sleep through the night. You've got my window.
That was Ben Gibbard from Death Cab for Cutie in conversation for FUV Live Sessions. A big thank you to Ben for making time to chat with me and to the entire band for the live songs. The music you heard in this episode was recorded at Studio Litho in Seattle, mixed by Jason McGurr and engineered by John Roberts. Our FUV Live in studio sessions are engineered by Jim O'Hara. Megan Suma produced this episode and is our executive producer. Our theme music was composed by John Crick. Be sure to follow FUV Live Sessions wherever you get your podcasts so you can listen to new episodes and find your next favorite artist, band, album, or song. Episodes drop every Monday. Please rate and review the show if you like what you hear so other music lovers can find it. You can also catch audio and video of FUV Live Sessions on WFUV.org. FUV Live Sessions is a production of WFUV in New York City. I'm your host, Alisa Ali.